and that Unitarianism, the gadfly of Mormonism. Dr. Larson is an archivist at the University of Utah Marriott Library, has a BA from Brigham Young University, a master's degree from Brigham Young University, and a PhD from the University of Birmingham in Birmingham, England. He will take about a half an hour to present his paper, and then James Allen will give comments. James Allen is a professor of history at Brigham Young University and co-author of Mormons and Gentiles, A History of Salt Lake City. Following his comments, we will open it for questions, and we'll proceed to that point. Can you hear me? Was there any magnification of that at all? Okay, well, I'll speak really loud. Bernice.
Good morning. I want to welcome you all here today. Do you think you'll be able to hear my voice all right at this level? All right. The expedition of Spanish Franciscan Fathers Atanasio Dominguez and Silvestre Velez de Escalante represents the first Catholic presence in Utah. Their 2,000-mile journey northward from New Mexico into the land of the Utes took place in 1776, nearly 215 years ago. The centennial, which Catholics of Utah celebrate this year, 1991, is that of the formal founding of the institutional church, the Diocese of Salt Lake City, created by Pope Leo XIII in 1891. This centennial commemorates not only 100 years of the existence of the diocese, but also the presence of Catholics in Utah since the time of Dominguez and Escalante. History records specific names of Catholics among the early explorers and traders and trappers, and finally, even among the pioneer settlers. These early Catholics gradually came together into a cohesive community, recognized by Rome first as a vicariate in 1886 and then as a diocese in 1891, 100 years ago. There are similarities between the journey of the diocese over the past 100 years and that of Dominguez and Escalante. The 1776 expedition evolved out of Spain's claim of political sovereignty over the western slope of the Central Rockies, including the canyon country of the Upper Colorado River and the deserts of the Great Basin. The main thrust of that expedition was the search for an overland route to Monterey, California. But just as important to the missionaries was their hope of sharing their faith with the Native American peoples along the way. Born in Santander, Spain, about 1750, Escalante had come to Mexico as a young teenager. He was ordained in 1774 and became a pastor of the Pueblo of Zuni. In the summer of 1775, he traveled to Ori in present-day New Mexico in the hope of reestablishing Christianity among the Hopi Indians, but was rebuffed in his efforts. It was perhaps on that trip that he gathered information about the Utah Indians living to the north, and then it might have been that he formed his desire to serve as a missionary among them. Dominguez, a native of Mexico City, then serving as commissary visitor of the missions in New Mexico, was 10 years older than his subordinate. But it was Escalante who kept the journal of their travel, preserving the observations of both men on the tribes they visited, the geography of the land they traversed, and indirectly, of their spirit of faith. A layman, especially important to the expedition, was Captain Bernardo Miero y Pacheco, who traveled as the cartographer of the expedition. His map and report, remarkable for their accuracy, would be praised as the first ever made of Utah, Colorado, and the adjoining regions. Escalante concluded each day's journal entry with an accounting of the physical distance the group had gained. Thus, the first day's report, dated July 29, 1776, recorded the trip from Santa Fe, capital of New Mexico, to the town of Santa Clara, quote, where we passed the night, today 9 leagues. Occasionally, Escalante qualified the distance, as in the entry for August 17th. Today, 7 leagues, he wrote, which in a straight line would be 4 to the north. Other entries, such as that of August 1st, recorded the ardors of a day. Quote, today it has rained very hard, and we have traveled 7 leagues. This expedition set the tone for the journeying of the Diocese of Salt Lake City through the past century. Like Dominguez and Escalante, the people of the diocese surfaced out of the 2,000-year heritage of the Catholic Church. They came at first intermittently, explorers out of the Spanish tradition, trailblazers, traders, and trappers, sometimes of French and Canadian descent. Then, with the discovery of gold and silver ores in the Intermountain West and the joining of the Continental Railroad in 1869, they came in greater numbers, miners and railroad workers of almost every ethnic origin. Some came in search of adventure, but most in need of employment and the very essentials of life. Catholic settlers were often transients, dependent on the progress of railroad line or the fluctuations of ore discoveries in mining camps. And they came to a land dominated by the Mormons, who had staked their claim in the desert in 1847 and had brought it to blossom. Several priests are recorded as having visited the area known as Utah Territory prior to 1866, but it's in Father Edward Kelly that the spirit of Dominguez and Escalante can first be clearly traced. Ordained by Archbishop Joseph S. Alemany of San Francisco in 1865, Father Kelly had built St. Augustine's Church in Austin, Nevada in early 1866. From there, he received a call from Camp Douglas, Utah, to attend the sick and dying. It's unknown whether he came to Salt Lake as pastor of Austin, intending to establish a mission, or whether he came upon special assignment. Archbishop Alemany would likely have desired to send a priest to look into the situation in Salt Lake City, for in the westward movement of America, no Catholic bishop knew quite what to do about the land of the Mormons. The Mormon community was stable. It was planted permanently upon the land. Not so the Catholics. They were soldiers, mule skinners, stage drivers, telegraph operators, prospectors, tavern keepers, men who, except for the merchants and the professionals among them, might pick up and leave at any time. Still, they needed the ministrations of a priest. And with Father Kelly's arrival, the Catholic Church more formally committed itself to the people of Utah. Today, as Escalante might have written in his diary, 7 leagues. Father Kelly took rooms at a residence on Emigration Street, which is now 3rd South, and lectured in Independence Hall on the evening of May 25, 1866. The following Sunday, he offered morning mass at 11 o'clock and baptized 2 children. The following Sunday, June 3rd, he offered early mass at Camp Douglas and a later one in Independence Hall in the city, and shortly thereafter traveled to Stockton, then the only town in Utah founded by non-Mormons. He remained there a week, returning to Salt Lake on June 17th. By the time he took the Overland stage back to August on June 23rd, he had taken an option on a lot on which he hoped to build the first Catholic church in Utah. To this day, the conception occasionally rises that Brigham Young gave the Catholic Church this property for its first church. In reality, Father Kelly paid the full market price, $2,300, for the small property, 50 by 165 feet in size. But the title to the lot was not clear and was, in fact, contested. Father Kelly and the contestant agreed to ask Brigham Young to arbitrate the conflict, and he decided in favor of Father Kelly. Thus, he helped Catholics obtain the clear title to their first property in Utah Territory. On September 3rd, 1866, Father Kelly again returned to Salt Lake City, though it's unclear whether as a pastor or as a special delegate of Bishop Eugene O'Connell of Marysville, under whose jurisdiction it's believed Utah Territory had been transferred for the period of 1866 to 1868. But it was clearly Father Kelly's intention to build a church on that little lot that he had purchased. While in Salt Lake, he was drawn into the religious and social turmoil during that period. Dr. King Robinson, formerly assistant surgeon at Camp Douglas, and at the time engaged in a lawsuit with city officials over the ownership of the Warm Springs at the northern outskirts of Salt Lake, was brutally murdered on October 22nd. Rumors flew that this was a holy murder perpetrated by Brigham Young's henchmen. Father Kelly received a warning to leave the city. He took the threatening letter to Brigham Young and was assured that it was not of Mormon origin and that he had nothing to fear. Though further change in the jurisdiction of Utah Territory required the recall of Father Kelly before he could construct the church, he did return to visit Salt Lake City 10 years later in 1876. Again, he received the consideration of Brigham Young, who met with him at that time and gave him a new autographed book. Like Dominguez and Escalante, who traveled, as Walter Briggs says, without noise of arms, these early priests came into a land unknown to them to care for the Catholics there and to share their faith with anyone who cared to listen. Their missions were not militant, nor did they play any major role in what Robert J. Dwyer called the religious debate of unmitigated bitterness by which some non-Mormons in Utah, regarding themselves as custodians of national religious and political morality and in control of the most profitable sources of local wealth, opposed the practice of polygamy and succeeded in disfranchising the entire Mormon body. Dwyer wrote, quotes, "While it cannot be said that Bishop Scanlon was silent on the subject of polygamy, it is evident that he confined his remarks to his own pulpit, in moral discourse to his own people, and chose rather to cultivate amicable relations with individual Mormons, some of whom still recall his friendly spirit towards them during periods of sharpest antagonism," end quotes. Reciprocal efforts at peaceful association did exist, for example, in the friendship of Lawrence Scanlon and John M. McFarlane, director of the choir of the St. George Tabernacle. Their friendship began during the period when Father Scanlon was building St. John Church and School and Hospital in Silver Reef, Utah. At McFarlane's suggestion in 1879, Apostle Erastus Snow, leader of the Latter-day Saints at St. George, invited Father Scanlon to offer high mass in the Mormon tabernacle there. The mass took place September 25th that year. McFarlane had obtained the music for the Kyrie, the Gloria, and the Credo, which, under his direction, were beautifully rendered by the Mormon choir during the Catholic mass. However, it's unrealistic to imply any lack of hostility within the Catholic community toward the Mormons. The most prominent antagonist of the period preceding establishment of the diocese was General Patrick Edward Connor. His biographer, Brigham D. Madsen, writes of him, quote, "General Connor has left an imprint on the history of the American West. He can be remembered as the father of Fort Douglas, the first Gentile in Utah, the father of Utah mining, and the father of the Liberal Party. He was a determined and resolute fighter in defending his convictions, a real patriot who loved his country," who had fought for it in two wars, and a man who resented the slightest disparagement of the nation's values. Madsen continues, Connor was also a controversial and stormy figure. He was brutal and inhumane in his Civil War years against Indian tribes and was contemptuous of the Mormon people. End quote. Still, because Connor represents one of the few prominent figures for Catholics to cling to in this period of their history, they hail him as a hero. Considerably more representative of the spirit of the Escalante expedition, however, is Father, later Bishop, Scanlon, whose selfless perseverance continued over a period of 42 years. At a time when Archbishop Alamoni had difficulty finding any priest willing to serve the distant and difficult outpost in Utah and eastern Nevada, Scanlon volunteered for the work. His missionary zeal carried him by horseback, stagecoach, and rail to Catholics widely scattered throughout the territory, often in railroad and mining camps. With the help of the Holy Cross Sisters from Notre Dame, Indiana, he built churches, hospitals, and schools. Rome recognized him as its worthy representative by creating the Vicariate of Utah in 1886. The Diocese of Salt Lake came into being by papal bull January 27, 1891. Within its boundaries, the entire Utah Territory and seven counties in eastern Nevada, the new diocese numbered some 6,000 Catholics in an overall population of about 220,000 in Utah. Somewhat like Dominguez and Escalante, Scanlon didn't seem to realize what he had wrought. As his physical and mental energies waned toward the end of his life, he seemed more concerned with what remained to be done than with what he had accomplished. Yet, he had brought to fruition the dreams of Dominguez and Escalante. They had left Utah Lake in 1776 with the hope of returning the following summer to establish lasting missions among the Ute Indians there. But political confusion totally frustrated their hopes. Escalante died 4 years after the expedition at the young age of only 30. Considered a failure because the route to Monterey had not been found on the expedition, Dominguez was exiled, his heroic service regarded a superfluity in Mexico City. Yet their journey constituted a major contribution to the exploration of the Intermountain West. With Bishop Scanlon himself, they assured Catholicism a lasting place in Utah history. Again, today, 7 leagues. By the end of the era of Bishop Scanlon and his successor, Bishop Joseph S. Glass, the Cathedral of the Madeleine stood as an impressive symbol of the enduring Catholic presence among the Mormons. The journey of Catholicism in Utah was finally underway. During the tenure of Bishop Duane G. Hunt, fifth bishop of the diocese from 1937 to 1960, the policy of conciliation toward Mormonism as opposed to confrontation was reinforced. Himself a convert, Bishop Hunt was open-minded, careful to avoid any semblance of bigotry. Even in controversy, he showed respect for human dignity. In his work, The Unbroken Chain, Bishop Hunt expounded the thesis that, and I quote, "The church which our Lord established is continuous from him to the present day and will be continuous until the end of the world," end quote. He thus described the explicit denial of unbroken Christianity. And again I quote, "This is the point of view of the Mormon denomination of origin in the 19th century. I should like to point out to them that any break in the succession of the church organization or in the teaching of the gospel would have proved to be impossible. My life as a priest of nearly 40 years now has been spent in Utah in the center of the stronghold of Mormonism. It's inevitable, therefore, that in writing about the continuity of the Catholic Church, I should reply to the Mormon arguments which are directed against that same continuity. not that these come to me in the daily and friendly contacts with Mormon people, many of whom are excellent neighbors, but rather from speakers and writers who can't resist the temptation of censure of the Catholic Church. Neither now nor at any time do I propose to criticize the doctrine or practice or official of any other church or religion. I try always to obey the rule of my church everywhere throughout the world, that of preaching the Catholic religion only and of leaving others alone. End quote. From throughout the United States, Bishop Hunt attracted religious orders of men and women to the work of the diocese. He established 15 major parishes in Utah and several missions. Sacred Heart Mission in LaSalle in San Juan County provides an example of the generosity of a Mormon, Charles Hardy Red, Sr., to the Catholic community. Red offered the use of a vacant bunkhouse as a place where Mass could be offered. The bunkhouse was readied, and in the spring of 1957, Mass was held there for the first time. Later in the year, Mr. Red agreed to donate land where a church could be constructed, provided that each of his children concurred. An agreement was given by all the Red children, except for Hardy, who at the time was serving on a mission for the LDS Church. It took some time to reach him, but Hardy also gave his consent, and construction of Sacred Heart Church was made possible the following year. Some of Bishop Hunt's contemporaries, however, were not always as congenial with their neighbors. Father, who later became Archbishop, Robert J. Dwyer, rector of the Cathedral of the Madeleine at this time, had become editor of the diocesan newspaper and had begun writing his nationally syndicated column, The Intermountain Day Book, in November of 1934. For a time, the tensions between various faiths surfaced sporadically in his writings. One year, he criticized the public school teachers of Salt Lake for planning their annual concert on Good Friday, a sacred day in Catholic liturgy. In an article of November 27, 1936, he refuted charges leveled against the Catholic Church in Spain by Reverend Mr. Jacob Trapp in a sermon delivered in the First Unitarian Church in Salt Lake City on November 22nd. Dwyer wrote, and we quote, "We suspect that Mr. Trapp's anti-fascist sympathies have led him into certain carelessness in checking his authorities," end quote. Father Dwyer responded to an editorial of December 27, 1935, dealing with an episode of early Latter-day Saints history, which described the favorable reaction to Mormon teaching of a group of Wisconsin Indians. Father Dwyer objected to the fact that the author, Glenn Binion, proceeded, quote, "to draw a comparison between the simple catechesis of the Mormon backwoodsmen and the missionary methods of the Society of Jesus. In so doing, he committed himself to a number of assertions concerning the Jesuits and their principles, which are not only false, but absurd. Misrepresentations of a particularly infelicitous source. It's not a question of insisting Mr. Binion praise the Jesuits, only a question of fairness and historical accuracy. In the name of the Society of Jesus, one of the greatest intellectual and moral forces in the world, we protest these slanders." End quote. On May 8, 1936, writing in praise of the architectural distinctness of the cathedral, Father Dwyer regretted that, quote, "the recent article on Utah in the National Geographic ignored the cathedral's existence." And he later also complained that travelers are, quote, "herded through the grotesqueries of Temple Square without a suggestion that the city has more than that to offer in the way of architectural achievement," end quote. In the Register of April 21st, 1940, Father Dwyer published an article entitled "Reflections on the Recent LDS Conference," the semi-annual conference of the Mormon Church. The article is a discussion of Mormon theology and of evidences of doctrinal dissent at the conference. It's couched in careful and compassionate terms, but it contains the judgment that, in the reaffirmation of one of its fundamental doctrines, Mormonism, quote, definitely places itself outside the realm of rational inquiry and rests its case upon a philosophical impossibility, end quote. A reply in the Church News voiced the deep offense felt by the Mormons, particularly at the suggestion of doctrinal dissent. And a criticism equally bitter was published in the Salt Lake Tribune. To preserve a rapport between the Catholic and Mormon churches, Bishop Hunt felt it necessary to remove Father Dwyer from the post of editor. On November 19, 1950, Father Dwyer was restored to the editorship of the Register. The first native of Utah to be ordained a Catholic priest, Father Dwyer was named Bishop of Reno in 1952 and Archbishop of Portland in 1966. Death came to this archbishop in 1976. The policy of peaceful coexistence fostered by Bishop Hunt became one of cooperation during the tenure of his successor. Bishop Joseph Lennox Federal, sixth bishop of the Diocese of Salt Lake City, attended the sessions of the Second Vatican Council during the years of 1962 through 1965 and returned home with a mandate to carry out the provisions of the Council. Efforts at ecumenism were emphasized. In 1977, St. Joseph's Parish in Ogden established a covenant relationship with the Episcopal Church of Good Shepherd, whereby educational and social service programs could be carried out jointly. In an innovative program of expansion, Bishop Federal bought a building, originally used as a Methodist church, and later as an LDS ward, for renovation in 1967 into St. Lawrence Catholic Church in Heber. In 1980, he bought and converted a former LDS ward building into St. John the Baptist Church in Draper. On September 26, 1976, Bishop Federal presided over a solemn Eucharistic liturgy in the Salt Palace in Salt Lake City, honoring the joint bicentennials of both the Dominguez Escalante expedition and the United States of America, each of which had contributed so richly to diocesan heritage. Escalante's daily measure, today 7 leagues, resounded through the years once more. Upon the retirement of Bishop Federal in 1980, Bishop William K. Wiggin became seventh bishop of the Diocese of Salt Lake City and builds upon the spirit of cooperation established by his predecessors. He reaches out to people of all faiths and ethnic origins in both new and expanded programs of social service. In the ecumenical spirit he encourages, Bishop Wiggin and Episcopal Bishop Otis E. Charles journey to each other's cathedrals in an historic exchange of pulpits in November of 1982. Bishop Wiggin maintains a good rapport with officials of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. His requests for assistance in funding the interior restoration of the Cathedral of the Madeleine, undertaken in 1987 in conjunction with the diocesan centennial, brought enthusiastic and heartwarming support from throughout both civic and religious communities. Paradoxically, Catholics in Utah are members of the largest religious denomination in the United States, but are a minority in their home state, where they comprise barely 4% of the total population. While sharing the geography of the land with its neighbors, the Diocese of Salt Lake City offers the Escalante and 20 centuries beyond to Christ himself. Now, in 1991, the journey through the annals of Utah history continues for the Catholic Church. Again, today, 7 leagues. Thank you.
Is this going to work now?
You want to try this mic on your lapel?
I hear you.
Well, I appreciate the chance to be able to talk to you and especially learn what Seven Leagues is. I was wondering how that was connected, but that's clear to us all now. I recently heard a story that's purportedly true, but I think it might be just a little bit apocryphal, in which an elderly, and this occurred in rural Utah, an elderly Unitarian man had just passed away, and his widow, since there wasn't a Unitarian church within several hundred miles, went to the local bishop and asked if he would take care of burying her husband. And the bishop, of course, said yes. And but being careful, after he'd made that statement, he looked up any information in the bishop's handbook of instructions and couldn't see anything. So he checked with his state president and made a phone call. He wasn't in, so he left a message and whether it was okay to bury this Unitarian individual. Early the next morning, he got the reply from the state president. Yes, bury as many Unitarians as you can. So what I intend to do in the next half hour is to survey the last 100 years in which Unitarians have been in Utah, and focus on a few of the interesting contacts with Mormons and a few of the things happened within the Unitarian community. Actually, the last 2 years, I've been working on this project. The first of those, the earlier one, was to, in the Marriott Library, to catalog and organize and make a register for the 144 boxes of Unitarian manuscript material, a very large and important collection. And then, as an outgrowth of that, was a year spent on writing this history of the Unitarian Church. Now, I'll take just a very short minute for a little ad about our book. I co-authored with Lareel Miller, and Benchmark Books has it for sale on the table out there, and I think there will even be some brochures that Lareel can pass out afterwards. I think it's a good book. It's got 116 illustrations. It's surveys not just the history, and I think perhaps even more important is that we record at least one sermon by each of these ministers in the Unitarian congregation in Salt Lake for that 100-year period. There was one that is missing because there were no reports, no copies of sermons or no reports in the newspaper. But it gives a nice view of Unitarian ideas and principles that survey this 100-year period. So that's the end of the little ad. Now, Unitarian organization began in 1891, February the 24th. It was organized here in Salt Lake City. The interesting thing is that in that the few months before that, they were deciding on a name, and at that period of time, there were a number of liberal churches throughout the West that had been known as People's Church, a populist kind of thing. But because at the same time there was the People's Party, which is Mormon influenced, and there was even a People's Cooperative. What they found, this was before it was organized, in say, the December and perhaps into January, they would have a few meetings and it would be advertised in the paper that the People's, there was a discussion about an organizing the People's Church, and they found that there were a number of Mormons that read that and came and expecting it to be a Mormon sermon, and then when they were disappointed, disgruntled, they left and caused a little bit of commotion. So they decided to avoid anything to do with the People's Church, and it was decided on Unitarian Society. The church didn't actually become a church until 1962. So during this period, I'll use the word church quite a bit, but it was really the first Unitarian Society of Salt Lake City. The first minister's name was David Utter, and he was a very, very talented individual. And in fact, within a year of becoming minister, he organized a Unitarian conference. Now, the interesting thing, it was a very ecumenical group. It was located in the Jewish temple here in Salt Lake City. And so Rabbi Moses P. Jacobson was invited, and he spoke. And then there was a Unitarian response to the Jewish position. And then the Presbyterian Church was represented by Robert G. McNeese. and the Mormons were represented by Bishop Orson F. Whitney, and then Joseph H. Crooker of the Unitarian Church in Montana was also here, along with Reverend David Utter. So just to show you how sometimes the statements that were made were then responded to during this conference that was set up by the Unitarians, understandably, Bishop Orson F. Whitney described the Mormon view of God with the well-known epigram that as man is, God once was, and as God now is, man may be, or man may become. There's a little difference in the early versions of that. Anyway, the Unitarian minister responded, and he said, it was described to him in the newspaper as he stood appalled at the sublime audacity that dares to tell us what kind of a being God is and how he came to be God. Then it was the reporter was actually a Mormon, and he then described some of the things that Reverend Utter, who was a Unitarian minister right here locally, described the position of the Unitarian Church as being just another name for infidelity, whose teachings ignore Christ as a divine being and scout the idea of his apostles being inspired by the Holy Ghost. So you can see that there wasn't always a congenial atmosphere, because the liberal point of view of the Unitarian Church was often very diametrically opposed to both the Mormon, and we'll even have a couple Catholic quotations here of how the response was to different people in the local community. One of the things that David Utter also said when people would castigate the Unitarians for being so liberal and denying some of the things that other people took as sort of second nature, he said he related to his congregation that many people say that these Unitarians are no better than infidels. And he replied to that very interestingly. He said that maybe so, for there are some infidels as good as some other folks, and I'd rather go to any hell that would fit Robert Ingersoll than go to any heaven that would fit John Calvin. Now, I didn't use a Mormon in there, but the idea of the traditional, say, Protestant fundamental position, that's how he put his situation. Now, another interesting episode occurred a couple years later. In 1894, there was a Hindu scholar who came from India and was visiting Salt Lake. Now, I don't know all the history of this. I only know the part that, and I haven't seen much discussion about it, but he came to study Mormonism, and he came and somehow was introduced to or got connected with David Utter, the Unitarian minister, and actually stayed in his home. And so he spent this period of time, I think only several weeks, studying Mormonism in Salt Lake, but stayed with the Unitarian minister. And another interesting thing is that during this period, there was a special reception in which this Nagarkar was his name, this Hindu scholar. He and David Utter were introduced and had a reception with the LDS First Presidency, this time Wilford Woodruff, George Q. Cannon, and Joseph F. Smith. And so we know that that happened, but we don't know too much that was the reaction. George Q. Cannon's diary is unavailable for anyone to read, and if Joseph F. Smith kept a diary, it's also unavailable. But luckily, we have Wilford Woodruff's diary that's now been published in toto, so we can look at this particular episode, and you can see his response. Wilford Woodruff was, to say the least, shocked to find that neither one of these two, Nagarkar or Reverend Utter, quote, believed in the Bible or Jesus as the Savior of the world or in the resurrection. I mean, these were like outlandish ideas that he was appalled at, and so that was his response. He gave a few lectures, this Hindu scholar, in the Salt Lake Theater, and then left. I guess we don't know where his tracks are when he went back, but at this one time when he was speaking and with Reverend Utter, we also have another insight in that Abraham H. Cannon kept a diary, and he describes Reverend Utter as a, quote, a smooth and dangerous opponent of our church because of these liberal ideas. Now, one of the things that's very interesting about David Utter, that he is noted by people who are studying folklore as Utah's first folklorist. And the reason for this is that he is the first one to record stories that Mormons tell about themselves or different episodes that are passed around And the reason for this is that very early, within that first year of the church, the Unitarian Church, Unitarian Society, being organized in 1891, one of Brigham Young's daughters joined. Her name was Ardell Young Harrison. And she spent quite a bit of time with Reverend Utter telling him, and I guess giving him the insight from her point of view of what she had learned as a young girl growing up in Brigham Young's very large family. She was actually a daughter from the 10th wife, Emmeline Free. And anyway, he recorded this story. It's one of the three Nephite stories, the first one ever published. And he sent it to the Chicago Folklore Society, and there it was published. So I'll just read a little bit of this account. This is how it was recorded. At the time of the crucifixion, Christ came to America and gave an epitome of the gospel to the people here. And then it tells a little bit about how this set up the story of the Nephites, which was recorded in the Book of Mormon. And that at the time that Jesus was visiting them, they requested that they could stay and remain on the earth. This request was granted, and so they remain. All this you may read in the Book of Mormon. Now, the Mormons took up this, quote, wandering Jew legend with avidity, and many of the saints now living, see, this was in 1891, can tell that they have at different times seen one or more of the three immortal Nephites. A daughter of Brigham Young, this is that one that had joined the Unitarian Church and was the confidant to tell him this inside story. A daughter of Brigham Young, now a good Unitarian, has told me that her father, which would be Brigham Young, told with great and solemn pleasure of an interview that he had with one of these remaining apostles, that's one of the three Nephites, in Liverpool when he was there on a mission. The apostle met him at the chapel door. An old man with long gray beard made himself known and spoke many encouraging and helpful words. And so that account, then, as I say, was published in this Chicago Folklore Society publication and began the study of Mormon folklore. So he is credited with being the first Utah folklorist. Another interesting individual who wasn't a... he was a member of the Unitarian Church. In fact, one of the charter members there was back when they organized in February of 1891 was A. Theodore Schroeder. And he... was a local lawyer in Salt Lake and later went back east and published a number of things, and some of them were very controversial, but at least during the time that he was still in Salt Lake, he spoke as the sermon. You know, some these ministers didn't always speak every week. They would have visiting speakers, and so he spoke in February of 1897, and his sermon was entitled Thoughts Suggested by a Study of Mormonism. He talked about a number of things about the early LDS church origins and Joseph Smith, and his view on this one point was that the prophet Joseph Smith had the revelation on polygamy, quote, only after he had been caught in adultery by an angry wife. Now, if you want to do some more reading, you can read about... The Emma book that was published a few years ago, in which some of these things, the background for it, are substantiated, and even things like Oliver Cowdery's description of it. Fanny Alger is this first wife. The interesting thing about her is that later she married a man named Custer, and both of them were very staunch and active Universalists, which is very near to Unitarians. It's very close. In fact, today the national organization for Unitarians is the Unitarian Universalist Association, because they are very close. So Fanny Alger and her second husband, I guess we should say, were practicing Universalists. Another thing about Schroeder, this same sermon, he talked about his response to the Mormon environment here in Salt Lake City. He said, when Robert Ingersoll and Thomas Paine robbed me of my superstitions, I lost only the value of a counterfeit dollar. And I am grateful to the robber, these two liberal thinkers, because he also led me out of the murky mists of ancestral superstitions under the sunny fields of free thought. So there's the liberal point of view, which puts rational inquiry and understanding, investigating, more than... leaps of faith and taking things on sort of a testimonial level. Now, we'll skip a little bit about the history, but one of the interesting episodes, and it's the only was actually taken care of by a husband-wife team. This was Raisin A. Maynard and his wife, Myla T. Maynard. And this was in 1897. For a couple of years, they were both ordained ministers, and they would alternate on the Sunday pulpit on who would give the sermon and so forth. Another interesting thing that we find out about them is that they gave their sermons on Sunday, but also during the week they had, one of them gave a Shakespeare class on Monday evening, sort of a early family home evening, I guess, literary discussion, something like that. And then Thursday, and this was in 1897, they both helped and conducted a class on evolution, the theory of evolution and how it affects our understanding of humanity and so forth. So that's an interesting thing. The other thing that I got permission and was told I mustn't die on the way back is I got a permission to bring the only copy that we have. There's actually two issues, but no one else seems to have any copies of the publication by the Unitarians, and this was in 1898. It's called the Unitarian. Later on, when they have their newsletters, each minister would think of the name that he wanted to use for his periodical, but that's what it was here. And in this particular issue, Myla, her sermon from that Sunday is printed. I won't read that, but these are all available. But I'll just tell you, inside it has a few of the ads of the local merchants and so forth. But one of the things where she summarizes, or maybe they both do, they could have both written this, it doesn't say who wrote it, some of the basic fundamental ideas of Unitarianism. First, freedom of reason and freedom of conscience, the method in religion instead of tradition and authority. So they don't put much countenance to mere authority or the tradition, but rather to use your mind to think about things. Two, fellowship, the spirit in religion instead of sectarianism. Three, service, the aim in religion instead of salvation for self. Thinking of becoming saved yourself, you think of serving other people. Four, character, the test in religion, instead of ritual or creed. Now, the interesting thing about this is, see, this was published in April of 1898, and just within a few weeks later, they both contributed an article to the newly organized, it was in 1897, so it was just a year old, the LDS Improvement Era. And so they wrote an article in which they restated some of these same things, and it's interesting on the one where it says, service is the aim of religion. In the Improvement Era article that they published, they said service and love, the aim in religion. So they added that extra aspect. Maybe there was, we don't know the story of the reason for it, but at least that was published for the Mormon audience at this time. Now, I won't go into any details about what happened after the Maynards left. It's a story that is interesting in its own right, and was what happened essentially in a nutshell is that the Unitarian Church, because of certain scandals, completely collapsed for almost 2 years. Not a single meeting, no members, no activities, no ladies meeting societies and so forth from 1899 to 1901. I won't go into the details. All the material has now been published. It's interesting, and we say this, both Laurel and I decided when we came across this and began to find out the details, that the 75th anniversary had been written 25 years previously by two very competent Unitarian women. But they knew about what had happened, but simply said nothing about it. And we decided what we find, we're going to talk about, we're going to say it as openly and honestly as we can. So that whole episode, it's not really, by standards today, it's no big deal. But certainly back in those days, the internal scandal caused the church to literally collapse. And for 2 years, almost 2 years, nothing occurred in Unitarianism in Salt Lake City. Then the national organization sent a minister named Philip S. Thatcher, and he came and for his Easter sermon in 1901, which he delivered at the Salt Lake Theater. They'd often used that before they had their own building. It was very enthusiastically received, and they were working on getting themselves organized and set up again. And they even had a new board of trustees chosen, and his name was Henry A. Whitney, and he made an interesting statement that was certainly very optimistic, that didn't turn out to be true. He said that they should, within 2 years, the Unitarian Society would be the strongest organization in the city outside the dominant Mormon church. Well, they didn't make that, but at least they got established again. And Philip Thatcher was quite successful and said a number of things. Now, of course, he came new to Utah and to Mormonism. And after he'd been here, let's see, I suppose about a year or maybe two, he gave a little assessment on what he felt about being a Unitarian minister in this Mormon culture. And he said this in one of his sermons. Let's see, this was, I guess, the next year. The Mormons are very different from the popular conception. Their faults have been exaggerated and their virtues overlooked. Submission to church authority is insisted upon, but many have leaped over the barriers to find a congenial home with us. So many had actually come over to the Unitarian position. The apostate Mormon has a respect for us, that is, for Unitarians, which he will not extend to other churches. All the Orthodox churches combined, I don't know about these statistics here that he's going to say, might be a little bit exaggerated, but at least the essence is there. All the Orthodox churches combined throughout the state have not made 200 converts from Mormonism in 20 years. That seems a little bit much. But more than twice that number actively sympathize with us, clearly proving that the old faiths cannot interest those who outgrow Mormonism and that Unitarianism can. So there, this was one of the things that he found after having been here for a while. Then, during the time that he had left and there was a new minister being searched for, the person who was the head of the board of directors wrote a letter to the national headquarters and talked about the kinds of qualities that they wanted to get in the next Unitarian minister that was to come. And they said, you know, he has to be able to not just give a good sermon, he has to be amiable and be able to socialize with people and, you know, think of interesting and provocative and timely things to say to keep the audience, and hopefully would be someone that he said would be able to stay with him and make his home there. And then in this report, again to the national headquarters, he said this: the field here is an excellent one, owing to the fact that the dominant church, Mormon, is continuously losing members of the more intellectual class who are seeking liberal thought and will turn to us. So that was how he felt, and I think that the statistics are hard to guess, but even today, some 40% of the Unitarians are ex-LDS people, and that several people in the earlier period seem to indicate the same thing. One of the next men was Franklin F. Eddy. I'm going to have to go over some of these pretty fast. Franklin Eddy, he delivered a sermon. It was called Accidental Prophets. And, of course, a Unitarian position is that basically a prophet cannot see the future. He doesn't know what's going to happen. All he can do is read the signs, like a good weatherman. You can only see so far ahead. Things are happening, and you can guess this. And so he talked a little bit about them, mentioned a few, like Mary Baker Eddy and some of the things that she was talking about in Christian Science, and then kind of a whimsical reference to Mark Twain, who said that the very fact that it's so stupid and silly is going to make Christian Science popular and is going to help it to go. So however much he meant it, he pointed that out, and he said that no less loudly from the platform and press, the Mormons claim the future for their kingdom. And then, nor is the Catholic less modest in assuring the world that the one holy church and its faith is invincible as well as unchangeable. And then the interesting thing about this Unitarian minister is he talks and criticizes his own position. And I must admit that the Unitarian explains frequently that modern science and the spread of intelligence paves the way for a new statement of religion which shall be in harmony with common sense. Then he goes through a couple other examples. And he said, which one of these is right? Not a blessed one of them, probably. Yet they are all prophetic, if accidentally so, simply because they are as straws which show which way the wind blows. So they are able to maybe get some things right, but who knows? He was able, I think, in that way to criticize his own position in what they were looking at. Skipping now along to 1923, and again what happened is that there was, in this case, another Hunt. He was a Reverend Frank Hunt, who was a Unitarian minister, and he had been selected by the group and was scheduled to come. But he didn't get here on time, and so the the pulpit was, well, he was there that day, but this pulpit was taken care of by a person who had already been assigned, and believe it or not, this was a LDS general authority. It's hard to believe that today, certainly, an LDS general authority would fill in for the Unitarians and speak one Sunday while they were getting one of their new ministers in. But Levi Edgar Young, who was a faculty member of the University of Utah, as well as one of the first seven presidents of 70, spoke on this particular Sunday at the beginning of Reverend Hunt's tenure here in Salt Lake City. Now, I must tell about this one episode that was very interesting because I think we found out something new in the process of doing some research on the book. What happened, and again, I approached this from the documents that we had at the Marriott Library. In this case, it was dated in 1945, and there's the minister was J. Raymond Cope. He had been a professor, Dr. J. Raymond Cope. He'd been a professor of philosophy back east, and then he came here as the Unitarian minister. And he tells, and we have the copy of his letter, and we have the original letter that the LDS president sent in return. So we have these original documents, and we began to look at them and try to fill in, sustain the general authorities of the church. And he said that the message in that disturbed him a lot because he didn't think that this kind of reliance on just authority for authority's sake was a good thing, a good, healthy situation. But he didn't do anything about it. He decided, well, that's up to them to do as they see fit. But what happened is that within the next couple months, several prominent, emotionally upset Mormons came not to their bishop, but to him as a Unitarian minister, and began to tell him about how they were trying to handle this statement that had been published in this little essay or message called Sustaining the General Authorities of the Church. And then in this letter, he says that this one was a prominent Mormon doctor, local here in Salt Lake City, who, in talking to Reverend Cope, broke down and wept like a boy. And then it's only at this point that he wrote the letter to, I guess it's President George Albert Smith. And he said that he thought, without any kind of professional training as a counselor or as a psychologist, that this man was going through a dangerous experience because of what had happened. So he wrote the letter asking about it. And the passage, and this, we got this from the letter, the passage said, indicated kind of a blind obedience, said, Lucifer, this is the quotation, Lucifer wins a great victory when he can get members of the church to speak against their leaders and to, quote, do their own thinking. When our leaders speak, the thinking has been done. When they propose a plan, it is God's plan. When they point the way, there is no other way which is safe. When they give directions, it should mark the end of controversy. And that was the statement. Now, at that time, I had heard about this. I talked to several people, and they had heard about it, and no one seemed to know where it came from. So, and again, what I did is I followed this through from the letter, and then we had the original. And of course, we have the original letter that President George Albert Smith wrote back with his own signature, and here at the Marriott Library. So what he said is that 3 weeks later, President Smith responded by claiming that the statement was not actually written by a Mormon leader. So immediately, the whole emphasis had changed. I thought, now that's, we have to take that at face value. It must be the case. So what this must be is that some person locally, perhaps in a ward, but more likely in a stake, had prepared a message that was then duplicated and sent around. So I had to revise my working hypothesis and say, look, I can't say that the church did this. This was just some little overzealous stake, high councilman or something like that. And so I began to ask a little more, and then people didn't seem to know where it came from, and they said, well, check in the Improvement Era. And so I went and looked at the issues of the Improvement Era, and lo and behold, you find that for that month, the official church message for ward teachers in the Improvement Era, published by the church, was in fact this. And I checked the text. The text was exactly quoted right by Reverend Cope. So then I looked back at President George Albert Smith's letter, and he had already said that there were no Mormon leaders. Now, I find that a little bit stretching it. But then he went on and conceded and said that one or more of them, that is, in the context that meant the Mormon leaders, inadvertently permitted the paragraph to pass uncensored. So someone's involved there. But by their so doing, and here's still a quote, by their so doing, not a few members of the church have been upset in their feelings, and the general authorities have been embarrassed. So at least now we can, people that have heard about this, we now know the episode in which how it affected some Unitarians and some Mormons who didn't go to their bishop but went to the Unitarian minister and this stance. Now, just to bring it up to date, just a letter dated May of this year, unsolicited, came to us, and this is by someone that, in fact, he said he had often attended, this is a Mormon intellectual, a retired professor at one of our universities here, said that he often attended the Unitarian meetings in 1944 to 47, which is during this period. I knew personally Mr. Cope, J. Raymond Cope, and Mr. Wilson, which was the next minister, Ed Wilson. And I recall well the remark, when the brethren speak, the thinking has been done. The problem is, when the brethren speak, it is the thinking that has not been done, which is so vitally necessary if sanity is to be preserved. So that brings it into more of a up-to-date context. Reverend Cope had a number of other things to say. I'll kind of skim over the rest of this. One of the things that's interesting in the sense that it was 30 years before it happened is he, in the local publication that went out to the members, he had talked about a newspaper article in which a certain physician, a black physician in Georgia, had been barred from doing certain things. And then in this local newsletter to the members, he said, "Our most fervent prayer," and it's quite something for a Unitarian to pray, so he was really convinced that this is something that should be done. "Our most fervent prayer for Salt Lake City is that wise leadership of the LDS Church may revoke its doctrinal attitude on the Negro problem." And of course, 30 years later, a little over that, in June of 1978, that was changed. Now, the next minister is Harold Scott. I'll simply mention this about his episode as leader of the Unitarians. He delivered not only the Sunday sermons, but he delivered 182 Sunday morning addresses on the radio. And it was very popular. And of course, he knew that many of that unseen audience would be LDS. He both began and ended his little sermonettes as with this little epigram: "A great many people are Unitarian and do not know it." And so he was hoping that maybe he could get some more people into the LDS church that way. Well, I won't say much more about the last 30 years because our time is running short. But I would like to mention that one of the sermons is a real gem, a real jewel that's published in the book. And that's by Reverend Hugh Gilliland, who was a Unitarian minister here. And then resigned and still lives in the community, and we have reprinted his sermon. One of the things that he does, and I'll just summarize it, he says, there's so many good things about Mormonism, and he talks about the industry and the determination and the perseverance with things, the emphasis on the family, the positive view of man and the evolving nature of man, and this is a very optimistic kind of thing. Also, the organizational prowess of members of the church, that they can get in and they can get things done. Another positive thing is the high involvement, lay involvement of members. And so he goes on with all this. And obviously another thing would be the word of wisdom, he says, contains many words of wisdom. And you can't deny that this is people are healthier, and moderation certainly would be a better thing for all people. And then he says, with all these assets, you'd almost think I'd become a Mormon. And then the second half of his sermon is on the buts. He says, but there are other factors. And he calls them, he refers to it, and he defines what fantasy is. He calls it the fantastic theology. Not the great theology, but a theology based on fantasy, which he says is something that's an enigma, it's something unreal, it's something unverifiable, it's something that no one can know for sure. So he talks about that. And then I wanted to read one other thing, and then I know we've got to give time to, someone's got to respond to what we've been saying here, so we'll give Jim a chance to do that. But he did say this: "I can only regard Joseph Smith as an imaginative, intelligent, opportunistic, and perhaps reasonable young man who was also either the conscious perpetrator of a grand hoax or a most unusual example of self-deception, or perhaps both at various stages in his life. The Book of Mormon I deem to be the product of his fertile mind, which was influenced by his reading, his experiences, and the knowledge of his times. I would accept in essence some of these other views that were being discussed at the time." Now see, this was in 1966, and of course as you know, probably know, that B.H. Roberts, an LDS General Authority, had similar kinds of views on the origin of the Book of Mormon at an earlier period that wasn't published till after this came out. So I'll just end by saying that it's been an interesting and very exciting experience to look at the Unitarian history, and I can probably do nothing better than what Hugh Gilliland said at the end of his sermon, and that is that he hoped that the positive things in Mormon might someday in the future coalesce or combine with what he saw as the positive things in Unitarian Universalism, so that there would be that. I can't see how that's going to happen, but that would certainly be a nice thing to consider, and I leave this with you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm delighted to be here to comment on these two papers. Let me get my watch out so that I can at least try to cut myself on time, which reminds me of the story of the young Mormon who took a friend of his to church, and every time something happened, the friend would say, well, what's that for, and what's that for? And the young Mormon would explain that to him, and then the speaker got up and made an elaborate display of taking off the watch and putting it down front, and the non-Mormon said, well, what's that for? And his friend said, that doesn't mean a darn thing. You can go to sleep now. So I hope it means something. Let me comment on the papers in the order in which they were given. And the first paper, which is entitled, Today, 7 Leagues, Centennial Reflections of the Catholic Diocese of Salt Lake City. As one reads the diary faithfully kept by Father Escalante on that first Catholic expedition into Utah, one cannot help but be impressed with the commitment of Escalante and Dominguez and Miera and the others that are there, particularly those three, and to the idea that this mission was ordained by God. At the end of each day's entry, Escalante made entries such as, Today 9 leagues. Today a good shower fell upon us and we traveled 7 leagues. Today 8 leagues. Today 5 leagues. Today 2 leagues and a half. Today a little more than 6 leagues. It wasn't just 7 leagues in all of these. In one way, these entries represented simply a faithful recording of distance for the sake of the record. But in a symbolic way, they also represented grateful acknowledgement that the group had traveled just that much further on its divinely appointed mission. When the Catholics returned to Utah nearly 100 years later, they were on a different kind of mission. They intended not to explore, but to stay. But as Bernice Mooney points out, they also faced problems of various sorts, and their mission had spiritual obstacles that can, in a symbolic way, be compared to the physical obstacles of the 1776 expedition. As each of these were overcome, and as the Catholics became a respected and important community in Utah, the Church had made important progress toward what it perceived as its own divinely appointed mission. The phrase, then, Today 7 Leagues, aptly suggests this symbolic connection between the two and the continuing efforts of the Church in Utah. If I had to criticize the paper, and I'm not going to, except for this little point, I had to struggle a little bit until I got all the way through the paper to see what the symbolism of Today 7 Leagues was, the way it worked out, because she doesn't tell us right at the beginning exactly where it came from. But when I finally caught on, then it made a whole lot of sense. And I wish you'd have made that a little bit more clear to me right from the beginning. But beyond that, I thought this was a delightful paper, especially if judged on the basis of the implications of the title, Centennial Reflections of the Catholic Diocese in Utah. The paper is not a deep, philosophical, highly analytical tome, but rather a nicely written review of some of the highlights, emphasizing, I assume, what one good Catholic sees as she reflects on the meaning of her own people's history in this area that the early Catholic bishops didn't know what to do about. Let me just list a few of the things that I see are fairly important aspects of the things that she reflected upon. The idea of the need for a priest that she emphasizes right at the beginning as disparate groups of Catholics came into Utah, and they needed some guidance. The misconception that Brigham Young gave the property. I'm glad she cleared that up. And yet, that's connected with something that she emphasizes very importantly, and that is that there was still a congenial relationship between Father Kelly and other Catholic priests and Brigham Young in Utah, as Brigham Young helps with the legal aspects of it. The lack of militancy, which she emphasizes, and yet a recognition that certainly there was, it's understandable that there will be some hostility at certain cases, yet she emphasizes the lack of hostility in generally. And the story of the of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir in St. George singing a high Catholic mass was, I thought, just about as ideal as you can get in terms of understanding how two disparately or two quite different religions can come together and at least represent in a civil way some friendship, congeniality, and an effort not to be antagonistic toward each other. Bishop Hunt and the idea of unbroken succession, that sermon he gave on unbroken succession, shows, I think, beautifully how someone in a community can disagree with the majority of the community and yet disagree civilly. And I thought that was a very nice thing. At least it was important to me that that was in there. And I hope that the Latter-day Saints who have disagreed can disagree with the same kind of civil tongue in a sense that that Bishop Hunt disagreed. The Cathedral of the Madeleine, she didn't emphasize that enough. And Dwyer's justified righteous indignation that ought to be recognized as one of the architectural treasures here, I think, is something that and she is very justly proud of. I couldn't help, as I was reading this paper, to reflect on my own growing up. And I guess I just have to say that maybe I'm a good person to comment on this session, because my own attitude, even though I devoutly believe in everything that the Episcopalians or the Unitarians don't want the Mormons to believe, I devoutly believe it, in most cases. But I'm not sure about the thinking part. But I do like to think. I think it's awfully important to think. And in the process, I've always had a kind of ecumenical feeling for other churches and a great respect for other churches and the desire to find out about them right from the time I was growing up in the little town in Logan, Utah. And so I remember Father, Monsignor Stoffel now. I have a hard time calling him Monsignor Stoffel because to me he was always Father Stoffel when I was graduating from high school. And then finally when I came back to go to college about 1950, Monsignor Stoffel was there. He was conducting in the little Catholic church that had been built there in Logan. He was starting a Newman Club up at Utah State University to try to get the Catholic students together to do the same things that all the rest of us were doing over at the Institute of Religion. And we met with them often. And of course, Father Stoffel had a tremendous interest in Utah history and through the Utah Historical Association, why we got better acquainted with him. We used to even take our friends and go to Catholic Mass on Sunday on Christmas Eve and hear Father Stoffel give Catholic Mass. And I thought that was a delightful experience. And I remember Reverend Bishop Hunt and the reconciliations, not reconciliation, just the general spirit of conciliation that he seemed to represent and how that generally appealed to me. And so I have good memories of these things, and that's why I guess I empathized very strongly with Bernice's paper on centennial reflections of the Catholics in Utah. I remember one little incident, however, that I wasn't quite sure about at the time. Somewhere toward the end of the 1940s, there was a pamphlet came out. I suppose you've seen this. It was a Catholic missionary pamphlet, and it had a map of the United States or Western United States on the front of it. And the black spot on the map was Utah done in black. And the appeal of the pamphlet was how much money we need. It wasn't to be distributed in Utah. It was distributed outside of Utah to get more priests into Utah, because there are all these people all over this part of Utah that need help. Well, the thing that bothered me about the pamphlet wasn't they would ask for more priests, and all of that was legitimate, but in Utah, somebody got hold of it, and it looked like it was way out in the desert, in the wilds. You know, we did have oiled roads, but the only picture in the pamphlet was of that little chapel in Logan, and they hadn't planted the lawn yet, so you saw the weeds and everything around the chapel when they took the picture, and it was a little bit of propaganda. I'm not criticizing, I just say those are some of the things that I remember, but other than that, the friendship and everything was congenial. And so I appreciated the paper that would, in a very nice way, give the point of view and the history of a group in Utah that is very important, even though it only has 4% of the population of Utah. I think it's important symbolically as well as in other ways to recognize that there are other religious traditions in Utah, and that when any of us write about Utah history, certainly the Mormon tradition will be there, but to ignore the other traditions is a tragic thing to do. And especially now, since we're celebrating the centennial, both of Catholicism and of Unitarianism, excuse me, in Utah. With respect to Unitarianism, I have to admit I've always had great respect for Unitarianism too, especially since I read several years ago, I can't remember, but that great 1819 sermon of William Ellery Channing, and one of the essays in this book, in the last part of this book, is a critique of the 1819 sermon of William Ellery Channing. That's a very, very nice critique, but the Channing sermon was a very nice sermon. Well, Unitarians appeal to the intellectual. They appeal to the people who are free thinkers. They appeal to the people who want to be bound by no authority. And I think there's a little bit of that in all of us, no matter how much we are dedicated to the authority of our own church, whether it's the Mormon or the Catholics or others. There's still a little bit of that free thinking that likes people that will examine things on their own and that will appeal to authority, or not appeal to authority for every decision that they have to make. In that sense, I think an overview of Unitarianism is certainly an important thing. And actually, Stan, you didn't need to stand up and give a plug for your book, because I was going to do the same thing and you stole my thunder, because this is a delightful book. It's a nice survey. About the first 166 pages is the actual history of the Unitarians, basically focusing on the ministers and what they did within their ministry. And then the last part of the book are selections of sermons, and he has already told you about some of the sermons that are in here. And it's very interesting and very worthwhile and very challenging, and I certainly would recommend the book. The problem with the paper is, well, maybe I can start out this way by saying that in a way, Stan threw me a little curve. He threw me two curves, actually, in the last little while. One is that the talk he gave today was very interesting and very good talk, but it was different from the paper that I read. So shall I comment on the talk or the paper?
I know
what he has done, really, is taken the episodes in the paper and woven them together in the talk that he gave you so that they make a lot more sense in the way they presented to you than they did in the paper I read. And so I came away, the first curve was to give me the paper I read, which I didn't consider very well organized because it was a series of episodes that weren't too well connected with any fabric. And he comes here and organizes it for you. So that's fine. I don't have anything to criticize in terms of the talk that was given. I do think a couple of things, however, might have been open to, well, so I say I questioned a couple of things in the paper, the way it was presented. As I looked at the paper, the questions that came to my mind were questions such, well, who were the first Unitarians in Utah besides Reverend Utter? What led to the first organization of the church? Did they, like other denominations, try to missionize the Mormons? Who joined the Unitarians and why? What was the relationship through the centuries? Was it generally antagonistic? Was it generally friendly and cooperative, or some mixture of these, or what? Well, all of that's dealt with in the book. But in the selection of episodes that I read in the original paper, what seemed to come out was a selection of episodes that emphasized, for the most part, the negative, the conflict, the antagonism, the criticism of the Mormons by the Unitarians. And while that was there, I couldn't help but wonder, well, isn't there more? Or was Unitarianism basically here as an antagonistic institution to be antagonistic against the Mormons? And you almost get that feeling from the paper. From what Stan said here, though, you get a better thing. And if this is to represent, to go as a paper somewhere, to be published somewhere as kind of a summary, he ought to add back into it the things that he gave you here. I had another fun little experience with the paper. I started reading through it, and I noticed that there weren't any footnotes, except there were some footnote numbers. And the footnote numbers kept jumping around from 31 back to 9 and that kind of thing. And all of a sudden I decided, I'll look at the book. And sure enough, what Stan had done very ingeniously, though I'm revealing your secret here, he had taken his computer thing of the book and excerpted these little things, and when this footnote jumps from 31 to 9, that's the next chapter, you see. And so it's really an excerpt from various chapters throughout the book that he took off his computer and let me read, and then he came here and wove it together in a very nice way. So I'm grateful for Stan for weaving together, but the most important thing about the two papers and the two traditions is that I think it's important to look, sure, at the strains that have existed within the various and among the various religious denominations. Look at the strengths and weaknesses that might be there in all groups. But also take a look And this book, plus Bernice's paper, do that. Take a look at the positive contributions of all other churches. Take a look at the efforts at conciliation. Take a look at the efforts of cooperation that have tried to help build Utah as a community. And I think that's the important thing we should do on this centennial of these religions. Thank you very much.
Does anybody have a burning question? We've got about 5 minutes.
They said we should repeat the question for the recorder, so I guess it's how does the Mormon concept of God relate to the Unitarian? And it really is diametrically opposed in this sense, that the Mormon concept and this statement by Lorenzo Snow that that you will, if you do what's right and follow the rules, will become a god. Therefore, there are many, many thousands, perhaps millions, that will become gods. Unitarian, traditionally, was a reaction to Trinitarianism, which meant that there was the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, all of which were three gods and yet somehow one. And, you know, they reacted against that and said, no, there's only one God. Jesus was a great man, a good teacher, a nice guy. And whatever the Holy Ghost is to help people think better, give them inspired thoughts and so forth, might be something. But certainly Jesus was a real person. Jesus of Nazareth lived and taught and was a good person, but he was certainly no God. And so they reacted first by saying that God, the Unitarian means one, and so that there is one God, and the other guys, other prophets, Jesus being one of them, would fit into that category. However, to bring it up today, Unitarians have gone further than that, and they're open-minded, so that they don't say there's one and only God. They would say now, at the most, there's one God, but there are many Unitarians that believe there is no such thing as a God, and that any concept of God is irrational, is that what is important is, like you were saying earlier, humanity, human beings, the human condition is the thing that we know about, can work with, and so forth. So in Unitarianism today, there's quite a wide range, and you can see that in some of the sermons. Some of them talk about a God, some of them talk about being agnostics or maybe even atheists, and all that fits into it. So it's quite a bit different than Mormonism.
And when he talks about priestly, though,
does have something like that.
There is something like that, but the point is that the Unitarians would say that humanity can increase to perfection as humans, not something superhuman and therefore to become a god. If anything, they're all on that level. Now, I think, I don't know about our time, but I think maybe just one last question.
One
you had your hand up couple times.
I just wanted to ask that Unitarian
that's real active. So again, that emphasizes and underscores the idea that the Unitarian position today is very broad-minded and very open-ended. They don't have any creeds or any dogmas or statements of faith. It's a very open thing, and the emphasis is on rational understanding, and that's going to change with generation to generation. So you see that same change through the history. Well, I think our time is just about up because you'll want to get to the next book.